Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. It's January 9th, and our region is experiencing some of the coldest weather of the year. While most of us can get in out of the cold, there are many people in our region who are unhoused. Some people stay with friends, others live in cars, and some, even on these coldest days, are sleeping outside. High rents, a lack of market rate and affordable housing, plus a high cost of living make it challenging for many, including teachers, first responders, and healthcare providers, to find housing. Today, we talk about the challenges facing those in our community who are currently unhoused or at risk for losing their housing, and some of the supports and services available. And we zoom out to discuss how the new Trump administration could impact programs for homeless prevention and the U.S. Supreme Court's decision last year to allow cities to outlaw camping in public places. A lot to get to. Joining us is Philip Mangano. He's president and CEO of the American Roundtable to Abolish Homelessness. Hi, Philip.
Hello. Good to be with you, Mindy.
Laura Russo is director of the shelter services at St. Joseph's Shelter in Hyannis. Welcome, Laura.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Alisa Magnata is CEO of Housing Assistance Corporation. Hi, Alisa.
Hi, good morning.
And Hadley Luddy, CEO of Homeless Prevention Council. She's also the state representative for the 4th Barnstable District. Hi, Hadley.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
So each January, there's a point in time count, of the homelessness on the Cape and islands. And not only does it give us numbers, but it also helps us see trends. I'm wondering if one of you could describe how this count takes place, because we're trying to find folks in cars, abandoned buildings, as well as people who are unhoused, but maybe in shelters. Alisa, maybe you might be the best one to talk. How does this work?
Well, it's a multi-agency approach. A lot of people, a lot of agencies contribute to identifying the people that are unhoused or who are living in shelter, and the county collects the data and then publishes it. It's really only a small slice of really what's happening in the marketplace. It doesn't tell the full story, but it is good to, you know, have that point in time, that count, and then be able to add to it with, stories. I'm sure Hadley has stories and Laura has stories of people that wouldn't quite fit into the count, but that we definitely see on our caseloads.
Yeah. Anybody want to add anything to that? No. What are the trends we're seeing, Hadley?
Well, can I just add one thing? Yep. Because, you know, for example, on the point in time count, it's not really showing the full number of people that are living outside. For instance, right now on our caseload, on our homeless outreach caseload, we have 350 unique individuals on our caseload. 192 are living outside.
Wow.
That's not reflected in their car, outside or in their car. That's not really reflected in the point in time count because of just the various rules and way that the point in time count is collected.
Yeah. Hadley?
I think importantly, Mindy, what you said earlier is important. The point in time count is hardly scientific, but it does show trend lines. And I think what's sobering for the Cape is that the trend line is up. It's up every year for the last 4 years to highest levels ever. So that's a trend. Our work together is to abolish homelessness, to end it, to get those numbers going in the right direction, which is down towards zero. But the numbers in the last several point in time counts show a trend up.
Yeah.
And that's bad news.
Philip, and you're looking, I know, at the national level here, and one of the things we look at nationally, the numbers have been up since 2017. They've gone up repeatedly, right?
Well, most dramatically in the last 2 years. What the recent report that came out from HUD after they sat on the numbers for literally a year demonstrates that it's literally the highest number of homeless people ever recorded in our country. Over 770,000 homeless people. So you're right. The trend on the Cape is not different from the national trend, and that trend line is up, and it's especially sad in terms of the last several years where the increases have been 17 and 18% each of those years.
Yeah. How do you want to
add? I just would say I'm so glad you brought up that point, because I think it was 17% that HUD came back with last year as an overall national increase. Just to speak to some of the trends that we're seeing locally, and this is really specific to the lower and outer Cape. We saw about 125 people categorized as homeless in 2024. Again, there could be many variations. To Elisa's point, this is where I think the point in time count, it's very helpful, but it also is sort of a slice at one point in time around who is actually, chronically homeless at that moment. But we're seeing everything from folks living in their cars to people couch surfing, and feeling like somehow, moving from house to house or friend to friend doesn't feel like it really categorizes them as being homeless. There are folks living in tents, really doing all that they can do to sort of remain independent, and not have to go into shelter or some sort of emergency situation. But what we see too that I find increasingly disconcerting is that our largest growing need of people coming in for prevention services, right? These are people really eager to find a way to remain stably housed and financially secure, are ages 25 to 54. And I always point out the fact that that is our workforce, right? Those are people that are working hard and full time. That is increasingly continuing to be our largest growing demographic, certainly at Homeless Prevention Council. And I think this is a trend a lot of other organizations are seeing too. And we also have seen a big uptick in the number of young kids being served. And one example of that I'd give is the holiday program that HPC ran this year went up in need by 105 kids. That's a huge jump in 1 year in a rural seasonal community like ours. So the good news is that people are coming out to get support, right? I always try to tell that side of the story because if our goal is to have no homeless people in our community, then it's terrific that they're reaching out. But the fact that they're reaching out at the numbers and the levels that they are is just continues to be really disconcerting.
Elisa.
Just to add to that, and on the homeless side, to give some context, when I first started working at Housing Assistance in 2017, our caseload was between 50 and 80 people, and now our caseload is consistently 350 to 400. So it had and the population where we're seeing a large increase that maybe Laura can talk about are the elderly, people who are very fragile time in their life, who are on our caseload. Recently we had a 90-year-old woman. Best case scenario for her was to move into her car when her rental sold.
Laura,
So
go ahead.
it's yeah, it's hard, heartbreaking.
Laura, what are you seeing?
So what we're seeing at the shelter, St. Joseph's, is an increase in the wait list. I think at one point we had 75 plus just on the male wait list. Usually the women's, usually the high might top out 25 to 30, which is still a lot. And our shelter, as you know, at St. Joseph's is a 45-bed shelter, 30 men and 15 women. And we are what we're seeing at the shelter where we're having issues are those, as we talked about, the folks, the elderly, the increase in the age and their mobility issues coming in. And many needing that a bottom bunk can only be on the first floor. And if you're familiar with our shelter, there's a lot of stairs. It's an older building. And the problem why our waitlist is growing is because we cannot house those with those mobility issues. And then the individuals coming in with physical issues, needing surgeries and such, and not having the place for them to recover from from medical procedures. So we are seeing an uptick in not only the age, but in the numbers as well.
I think a lot of people have a misconception about people with housing insecurity and would be surprised to hear that these are people they interact with every day without a home. We're talking about some of the elderly, but we're also talking about, many of the people, the workforce, Hadley, as you're mentioning. And Hadley, maybe you can speak a little bit about share some of the stories of who are these people who are finding their themselves in this situation with no place to live. It's a range, right?
A big range, absolutely. And I'm really glad to hear that the numbers brought up around our fragile seniors and older adults who are most definitely struggling with housing. And I think actually, just on a side note, that really goes to one of the challenges that we see around, one bedroom units and the availability for senior housing options for people that are fragile and need of a place to live. But we see a lot of folks, especially in the off season, who might be very busy landscapers, for example, during the season, who find themselves in a really tough situation in the winter. Generally, it's around paying rent, trying to keep up with that. It's been great to see a lot of towns develop rental assistance programs, which make a huge difference. Even though they might only rent for 2 to 3 years, they are critical and essential to keep people housed. We've had people who are part of the fire department. We've had EMTs come in. We've had people really, teachers, people of all sort of walks of life and professional backgrounds coming in who are either paying just an extremely exorbitant rent level, or just finding themselves at a tough point in their life where a number of things have happened and they're not able to make ends meet. And those are the folks that are the most vulnerable because once they lose their housing, there really is nothing to replace it with. So.
Let's talk a little bit about the social and emotional impacts of living without a home. This is very stressful for adults, but I mean, it also really disruptive for children. And we're seeing, at least we're seeing families with kids who are also unhoused. And you can even imagine, I mean, you think about adults, how do you get up and find a job when you don't have a place to shower, to change, to all of those, you get sick, you have the flu. It's a huge, huge impact for these folks.
Oh, it's le a legitimate, trauma event in people's lives that stays with them for the rest of their life and impacts their ability to get jobs, education, their health in the future, even when they become stably housed again in the future. People need certainty and they need options. And when that certainty is taken away, Maslow's hierarchy of need, right? When that certainty of your housing or your food is taken away, it's extraordinarily disruptive. Think about the people in California right now with the fires. It's heartbreaking. All of a sudden, no fault of their own, they are rendered homeless. They don't know how to work the system. They don't know where they're going to go. That is what happens every day in our region. Our region that is dependent upon private individuals to buy rental housing and turn it into an investment property that they rent out to the firefighters, police, teachers, healthcare workers, whomever. We are dependent upon those people making that strategic investment. And right now, the age of those investors is moving to retirement. And they're selling. The market's high, they're selling. And so what we're seeing is displacement because either the new buyer bought at such a high price they have to almost double their rent to make the mortgage payment, or they want to use the house themselves. So we continue to see this displacement. We continue to see these extraordinary high rents, and we don't see it changing in the future.
Elisa, do you see that some of these are going to Airbnb? How is that whole Airbnb thing impacting the rental market?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a component of Airbnb that we need to take seriously, and the short-term rentals, they are businesses, they need to be treated like businesses. But what we're really seeing in the trend is that the people buying have more money. They're more affluent, so they don't need to rent it. They're not necessarily buying it and then renting it short term, or doing the 9 month rental anymore. We're not seeing the people that, the retired teachers, that was a big population that moved here, that they would kind of bootstrap their second home, by renting it 9 months and then living in it in the summer, or doing some short-term rental. That's not what we're seeing. We're seeing that this people who it's their second, third, fourth home. So they're much more affluent. They really don't need the rental, and that's what's concerning, because we can't compete. Locals will never be able to compete with cash buyers that are buying their third or fourth home. It's just not, the math will never work.
Laura, I wanted to ask you about, we were talking about families being unhoused, but what you see in your shelter, you don't have children, but you're seeing some parents who are there separated from their children.
Right. So we probably have, I don't know, probably about 10, 15% who do have children but are separated, living with other family members, or maybe have had to go live in another state. What the shelter, though, has provided, especially a few of the women, is that that stability, to provide them that stable place. And right now we do have one parent who's been able to have reunification with her children because of the shelter providing that stability and that place to stay. Yeah. But it's difficult. It's difficult. It impacts, like we were talking about, their mental health, their well-being. But I just would also like to touch back on the workforce, is that we probably have right now about 35% of our clients do have full-time jobs, but are still, as you say, living in the shelter. In summertime, of course, that number, that percentage of our full-time worker increases. But still, these are folks working full-time mm-hmm. or in the shelter because they cannot afford the rental. So
Philip, talk maybe a little bit about the impacts on the greater community when people of middle to lower incomes can't find housing.
I think, you know, the issue of families, which we were just talking about, I think it's a sobering one in the Cape. If you look at the data, the number of families in shelter has, in the last 3 years, has actually more than doubled on the Cape. So there is a growing concern when you look at the data. Not only are individuals, not only are elderly people, and of course in the homelessness realm, you're elderly if you're over 55. So it's a very sobering number for some of us, of mm-hmm. course, in terms of that definition. But the numbers, again, are corresponding to what we're seeing across the country. And certainly when it's not possible to achieve housing, you're out because you don't earn enough money, you're out because there are insufficient affordable units, that has a very deleterious impact on family life and on the education of the children. I think what this all gets back to, whether we're talking about individuals, elderly, or families, is insufficient units. We haven't enough units. So if we're out begging for units from landlords, and that we've just heard that number of landlords is decreasing, then our concentration needs to be on the creation of units. How do we get units up and operational for families and up and operational for individuals? So, for example, in a number of other places in the country, the conversion of hotels and motels to housing, which have tenancies, literally the motel units are reconfigured to accommodate homeless tenancies. That's been one of the responses that's been made. And of course, there's been a lot of talk of reconfiguring office space that's not being used, movie theaters that aren't being used. But what it all comes down to is creating more units that are targeted to homeless people. And that's where creativity needs to come in. There are lots of different reasons why people come into homelessness. There's only one way they get out, and that is to have a place to live where they have a tenancy. So it's the creation of units, and that needs to be more of a focus, of course, everywhere around the country. And I think there are some, again, some creative things going on. And I know here on the Cape, Lisa is leading some of those efforts to increase the number of units that are available. It's a dilemma for sure.
Elisa, tell us what Philip's speaking to. What are we doing?
I love what he's saying. You know, there is a cure for homelessness. It's really very simple. It's just build more housing. We need the right kind of housing that can be scaled in our communities, that it's not a build, baby, build, you know, philosophy, but it is a build where we can think of housing as infrastructure. It's the same, has the same significance and importance as our roads, our schools, our police. Without that investment, we lose our community. We lose the economic viability of it. We lose the ability for any of our schools to even to remain functioning, and the taxpayer dollars that we spend to run these schools. It has a ripple effect. The lack of housing has a ripple effect that impacts all of us, our cost of living, our quality of life, in a very significant way. And as much as we still meet resistance on building housing and building housing in the right places, It's really the solution.
Right.
It's really what our region needs to do, roll up our sleeves and really get serious about, as we're talking about here, housing for people that are the most fragile in our community and people who are, making $100,000 or $150,000 as a police or firefighter or teacher, if they're working, if they're married and, in a household that can make that much money. So it's the whole gamut
Right.
is what we need.
We're
I,
talking.
I,
Go ahead,
I,
Phil.
I, if I could just quickly add to what Elise is saying, she's absolutely right about housing being part of the infrastructure of a community. Jobs depend on it, education. But the hard reality for homeless people, and we've seen this innumerable times, is that old dichotomy between housing and services and the argument, and of course, that's an argument that's going to go on in Washington now for the next 4 years. Which comes first, the housing or the services? But the bottom line is, housing is actually the most important service that can be delivered to a homeless person. It provides the stability and the context for them to be in recovery from mental illness, from addiction. It provides the stability to go out and get a job. So rather than make a dichotomy between the two. Actually, housing is the most important service. And then onto housing, you build those services which provide a stability for not only the tenancy, but a stability for the lives of the people in that family or for that individual. Housing as a service is so critical.
All right, we're going to take a break here. We're talking about the challenges facing those in our community who are currently unhoused or at the risk of losing their housing and some of the supports and services available. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join our conversation, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the challenges facing those in our community who are currently unhoused or at risk for losing their housing and some of the supports and services available. With us this morning is Philip Mangano, President and CEO of the American Roundtable to Abolish Homelessness, Laura Russo, Director of Shelter Services at St. Joseph's Shelter in Hyannis, Elisa Magnata, CEO of Housing Assistance Corporation, and Hadley Luddy, CEO of the Homeless Prevention Council. She's also the state representative for the 4th Barnstable District. Before the break, Elisa, did you want to add something to what Philip was saying before we move
Yeah,
on?
I just wanted to kind of illustrate a little bit more and add on to what he's saying, because it is such an important point that sometimes when we're housed and we're stably housed, we lose track of what it's like to have that insecurity, that instability. Housing is healthcare. I mean, literally in California, parts of California, doctors are prescribing rental vouchers and prescribing housing. And we can all remember back, during COVID, when the best answer and the best solution, the prescription, if you will, was to isolate at home. If you have chemo or the flu or any kind of, healthcare, you need to stay home. And if that is threatened, then everything in your world is upside down. And that's why Duffy has worked so hard for so long to create a medical respite program that will now be embedded in the shelter when we can open the new shelter at 460 West Main. So there's a lot of layers and a lot of our agencies working together to make sure that the slice of the person that we see, that we all can work together to augment and solve that problem together, that aspect of whatever they're experiencing together.
Yeah. Let's talk to Janet, who's giving us a call from Tisbury. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I couldn't agree with you, your position more. I'm alarmed when I listen to the news that the next president, Mr. Trump, he wants to treat everyone for their drug addiction. He does not worry about housing. And if you don't have housing in a situation where you can be confident and not freezing to death, et cetera, I just can't believe the stupidity of that kind of decision he's made.
Janet, thanks for your thought. And Philip, I'm going to go to you on that. A new presidential administration starts later this month. Do we have any sense of how a Trump administration might influence policy or funding for homeless programs and preventions? And what does the research tell us about forcing people into treatment?
Well, I think part of the difficulty here, and Janet is putting her finger on it, but there are others who think of it in a different way. Housing First, which has become the policy declared by HUD, they've declared that that is their policy on homelessness. And they declared that about 4 years ago. And sadly, homelessness has increased quite substantially in the country in those 4 years. And unfortunately, what that has led to is that folk in policy positions are conflating the idea that Housing First not only correlates with an increase, but is causative of that increase. Part of that unfortunateness is HUD declaring Housing First as their primary policy. So that allowed people like the Cicero Foundation, the Heritage Foundation, the Manhattan Foundation, all of them to do papers on accusing Housing First. The idea that the first thing you want to do for someone is place them in housing, and then in the housing, that provides the context for the provision of all the other services. So the challenge in the upcoming administration, and I've been talking to people in the administration, is that they're going to move very aggressively away from a Housing First strategy. They will claim that Housing First, again, correlates and maybe is causative of the increases that we've seen. And they're going to move to affecting treatment. So it's more of a shift from Housing First to treatment first. You treat the mental illness, you treat the addiction, and then the person goes into housing. As we all know, there are missions all over our country who do that exact thing. They've felt shut out of policy. They've seen their resources decreased in the last several years, or actually more than several years. And the war, literally the war between Housing First and a kind of services first agenda, that's going on right now in the discussions with, in terms of the internal workings of the new administration. And they are leaning very aggressively away from Housing First toward another perspective on providing services for people first and kind of curing people, and then they can go into the housing. So part of the, I think, the dilemma for all of us is to bridge that divide between Housing First advocates, and they are very orthodox about Housing First being the only way to move forward, and the mission mentality, which opposes Housing First because they see it as very threatening to what they're doing. That divide needs to be bridged. I don't think the next administration will be doing that bridging, but it's a very important part of the work that we need to do in homelessness policy, or this battle will continue to ensue, and attention will be moved away from the central thing that needs to be done, which is the creation of units for homeless people to go into, as opposed to a war between what comes first.
Right.
So it is a discussion that's going on right now with members of the incoming administration.
Yeah, Janet, thanks for the call. Lisa, you wanted to add something to that?
Yeah, I mean, I hope that they finally fund the treatment that's necessary. You know, we have several HUD grants and have HUD housing that they're happy to pay for a small stipend for the rent and give us no funding for any kind of services that are needed in order to keep the person safe and stable and to have that kind of upward mobility that we're talking about. So I'm hopeful that, you know, with this realization that that people need, that housing is just the first step and that people need services, that there'll be more money for services then. Mm-hmm. And it is a little bit of a scapegoat, though, because the real issue is that we haven't kept up with construction, not just on the Cape, but anywhere across the country. So the two go hand in hand.
Right.
So
yeah. All right. Let's talk to Fritz, who's giving us a call from Dennis. Hi, Fritz.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
I agree with just about everything everybody's saying with one exception, and that is, and this is specific just to Cape Cod, that we can build our way out of the homeless problem down here. We're in a very environmentally sensitive area, and the business paradigm of real estate on the Cape is such that we have, I believe this is true, more than half of the housing on Cape Cod is occupied for 3 months or less. We have plenty of housing down here on the Cape. The problem is the allocation. And the only way to solve that problem, to change the priorities of each town government, and every town has a different character on the Cape. I understand that. But we've got plenty of housing down here. It's just not allocated in the right place. I live on a dirt road, 20 homes, only three of which are occupied year-round. Mm-hmm. The rest are just sitting empty for 9 months out of the year. So anyway, that's all my take on it.
Fritz,
I don't think we can build our way out of this problem.
All right, thanks for your thoughts. Anybody want to respond to Fritz? Elisa?
Yeah, I do. I do. I love what Fritz is saying, that, and I agree that we're not going to completely build our way out of it. But the comment is a little bit infringing on property rights, right? Like, who are we to say when somebody buys a house how often they can use it or how it's used? So we're not going to all of a sudden like shake all the houses and move the people around. So I think it has to be a two-pronged approach. I think that we do need to recognize we do live in an environmentally sensitive area, and recognize where we can do reconstruction and redevelopment on existing buildings. We're doing, Housing Assistance is doing one here in Orleans that used to be Masonic Lodge. Now it's going to be 14 apartments, right? So there's definitely areas that can be leveraged that are not environmentally sensitive that can be leveraged for housing, and thinking about incentivizing that kind of behavior than the restrictive behavior or property rights of taking away people's property rights.
Go ahead, Philip. So, go ahead.
I could just say, I think Fritz's point really is aimed at being much more creative in how we're creating housing. You don't need to necessarily build your way. Fritz's very point is there's already a lot of housing on the Cape. Mm-hmm. So it's to build your way out of it. It's being creative in repositioning buildings to accommodate people so that they can live in tenancies and have housing. So it's really pointing toward being creative in terms of creating those units.
Yeah. I was going to say, Elisa, aren't we seeing, I was thinking, we're seeing a lot of the schools saying that, the student population is reducing. And I think, didn't they take one of the schools in Sandwich and make it housing? And they're talking about doing it. So, I mean, there's an option, too, with some of these buildings that are, aren't full anymore, right?
Existing, yeah. Well, schools are a little bit complicated because of how they're funded, and you have to go back to the grant money and the federal money that was given, or the state money that was given, to see if they can switch it over to another municipal use. So it gets a little complicated with schools, but I appreciate Fritz's point. It comes down to zoning. It comes down to what towns will allow the use to be of an existing building or in areas. And that's where towns can be more generous. That's where we as a people can be more proactive to allow, where there's infrastructure like sewer, allow more construction, allow second, third, potentially, fourth stories. I know that freaks people out, but in some areas, not in Orleans, but, in Hyannis, in some areas where there is more of a municipal city feel, and if not the fourth story, but allow density, allow more than one house per lot, which is right now only 2% of all land on Cape Cod is zoned for multifamily. Mm-hmm. Right, we're automatically constricting construction and the ability for us to add the right kind of housing that we know we can. We need and that we can build.
Yeah. Daniel writes, what about tiny houses? I saw something recently where, yeah. I mean, and this would be like, your family, if you want to put your grandparents in a tiny house in the backyard, but you're saying property, there could be places you could maybe come up with some tiny house neighborhoods. I don't know.
Well, tiny houses, you still have to fit into the infrastructure of your, wastewater and Title V
Right.
rules. Is it, when you say tiny house, does it have a foundation or is it mobile? You know, there's a couple distinctions here. We have done a good job in our region of allowing accessory dwelling units. They will now be allowed by right in the state, thankfully. So that is moving the needle along of those smaller
Right.
housing units that are actually going to be paid for by the property owner and not taxpayers, which is another beautiful. Yeah, exactly.
866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the challenges facing those in our community who are currently unhoused or at the risk of losing their housing and some of the supports and services available. With us is Philip Mangano, President and CEO of the American Roundtable to Abolish Homelessness, Laura Russo, Director of Shelter Services at St. Joseph's Shelter in Hyannis, Lisa Magnata, CEO of Housing Assistance Corporation, and Hadley Luddy, CEO of the Homeless Prevention Council. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Laura, you talked about a wait list. And so I'm wondering, and maybe Lisa can chime in after, like, how many shelters do we have in other? But what happens when your shelter is full? It's a cold, we're in this cold weather. Somebody shows up and you're full. Do you say, sorry, we buy? I mean, what happens?
Those are some difficult situations. So right now we are having our winter overflow program. So we're able to house an additional 18 individuals working with the host hotel. That it's a first come, first serve basis. We do an intake between 4:30 and 5:30. It's when the temperature is 30 or feel like 30 degrees, and then they will come in. The individuals come into the shelter. We do an intake, and then we transport over to the host hotel where they can spend the night. We then pick them up the next morning at 7 a.m., and then we transport them back to the shelter where they can come in during the day, Monday through Friday, especially with these very cold temperatures. We are letting them come in a little bit earlier than we normally would, but again, that's another 18 individuals that we are able to house. We also, our Duffy also runs a program as well. So we do communicate back and forth on who they have on a list, who we have on a list. So we are all working together to get these folks housed.
And you say intake. So who can and who cannot come into your shelter?
So they must be 18 to participate in the winter program. Our set of floors at the hotel is on the second floor, so we do try to get those individuals, again, who can go up and down. This is a hotel that doesn't have an elevator, so we are to try to get the individuals must be able to be mobile to go up and down
downstairs,
the steps.
Yeah. So, Elisa, what are the options? How many shelters do we have in the region, and what is the criteria? I know some are for adults, some are families. What are the options for folks?
Yeah. So for individuals, we only have one shelter. That's St. Joseph's. And for the family shelter, right now, there are five family shelters. And Community Action runs one. We run several. And then there are Independence House also has a shelter beds. So the family shelter and the DV shelter, people have to go through an intake process. They have to go through the state to then be admitted into the shelter. And then get moved to where there is a next shelter bed available. So where you see, like, and think about, like, the lines of people or people waiting outside to go into a shelter is really going to be at St. Joseph's. Mm-hmm. But I'll go back to the beginning of the call. You know, we're talking about 17 overflow beds and a certain number of in from the street hotel rooms. But we have 192 people that are living outside or in their car. And so, yeah, they get blankets. You know, they get a door knock to make sure that they're okay and not freezing to death. Every single program is fully exhausted and utilized. We don't have enough money. We don't have enough resources. We don't have enough beds. And often, you know, our best solution for somebody is here's a tent, here's a sleeping bag, here's a wool blanket and wool socks, we'll check on you. Yeah. It's heartbreaking and it's really, really hard for our colleagues who then go home to right. a place to not hang on those stories and those people. So we need more money and resources.
Yeah. Philip?
You know, the hard reality is that what the Cape is facing is what just about every community around the country is facing. We have lots of homeless people who are quite prepared to go into housing, especially when the appropriate services are provided to them. So there's no lessening of the demand for the housing. So the question is, where is that housing going to come from? And our attention needs to move away from the emergency, and our resources need to be targeted to the solutions for homeless people. The other, I think the real opportunity in the upcoming administration is the fact that services, as Elisa indicated earlier, HUD has moved away from services, I think appropriately. HUD can barely manage and operate and monitor the housing that they are responsible for. So when they were providing services, they were unmonitored and many untoward things happened in that era. What needs to happen is that HHS, the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, which has basically dodged the issue of homelessness for many years, they've made Medicaid a bit more amenable in terms of providing services. But in general, the companion monies that we were looking for to match up against the HUD housing resources, they never came. I think there's an opportunity with the person who's going to be the HHS secretary, namely RFK Jr. I think he will be open to listening to the services that people need. And of course, under his domain would be services related to mental health, services related to addiction, services related to physical disability, AIDS, HIV. All of those will be under his domain. And I think he could crack through the HHS bureaucracy and offer a companion grant to the HUD money. So when you got money to do the housing, you got companion money to provide the services. There's already a precedent for this. It's called HUD-VASH. There's a program in the federal government where you get a voucher for a veteran to go into housing, and it's matched by the VA in terms of the services. It's the most impressive and the most high-performing initiative on homelessness in our country's history. Mm-hmm. It's actually resulted in the lowering of the number of homeless veterans quite considerably. Even in this past few years, when numbers for every other population have gone up, the mm-hmm. veterans numbers have continuously gone down. So that matching of HUD housing resources with VA services, that's work. Yeah. We now need to do a companion effort in the federal government. HUD resources match to HHS resources to provide the services we need to stabilize those tenancies. It also speaks directly to that war that's going on between housing first and services. Right. It's a way to ameliorate that, and RFK Jr. could be the solution for that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Hadley, I want to turn to you for a second, because oftentimes people need assistance to meet an increase in rent, or there's an unplanned mm-hmm. expense that puts them behind the rent. What are some of the programs and resources available to help keep people in the housing they have when they have some unfortunate circumstances?
Right. So folks will come to organizations like HPC and be behind in their rent or mortgage, and they potentially can apply for RAFT, which is administered by the amazing team at HAC. And we work with them all the time in helping to really address arrears that people may have. There's a lot of other safety net organizations in our communities that provide additional resources to help with those types of shortfalls. I will also say, I mentioned it earlier, but rental assistance programs, I think they are critically important. Every town should have them. I think we could even be looking at rental assistance programs on a much broader county, statewide level for certain circumstances. The key to not even having to deal with the issue around homelessness is to keep people stably housed mm-hmm. and financially secure. So at the end of the day, I always just circle back to the prevention factor. And, you know, we're lucky that we've got a lot of great services in our community, but we need to do more. And I think it's fascinating to hear, especially Philip, some of your ideas on the national level.
Yeah. Elisa, mm-hmm. I want to ask you, because people don't understand this, but it's actually less, it's cheaper to keep people in their housing than it is to find them housing once they're homeless, right? So if we can just, I mean, more prevention programs would be great.
Yeah, 100%. Even we did a pilot program 3-4 years ago now that is now a rental assistance program that we run outside of our Section 8, and it's called Thrive. And in the pilot program, we learned that really only $500 a month made a huge difference for people. To everyone's point here, you know, these are working, productive people that just need that little lift to ensure that they can pay their bills, eat, pay their utilities, and really give the landlord that security and assurance that there is another agency and resources available if the tenant does get into trouble. So it helps as an investor for you to feel confident to hold on to your investment and hold on to that tenant.
Right.
So exactly what Hadley is saying, the affordability gap and the inventory gap, those are the two, it's a two-pronged problem and a two-pronged solution where you need to be looking at zoning and building housing for all income levels, but you also need to keep the housing that's here stable. Going back to Fritz's point, how do you keep the inventory that's here year round and available for year round? How do you incentivize that? And then how do you help the tenants that are living there bridge that gap that the income can't afford the rents of today?
Yeah. Let's talk to Jenny, giving us a call from Orleans. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. My question is, I am curious as to why none of the offices and the buildings which house the programs to help the people are not available to the people in times, particularly in these days when it's freezing. Like, there's no place for anyone to go down here from Provincetown all the way. As you know, we only have one shelter and it's in Hyannis. And so there's people who can't even have anywhere to go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, between the churches and between the, like, there's a house there.
Yeah. All right. Let's let Hadley chime in there. Hadley?
Yeah.
Well, Elisa, it looked like you had a point too, but there's no doubt that we are lacking resources, especially in the lower and outer Cape. We have worked for many years with Duffy Healthcare to utilize the In From the Streets program when we can. We have had over the years some hotel or motel owners that will work with us to put somebody up overnight, but it is a serious situation and a serious shortfall.
Yep.
No doubt. And Elisa.
Yeah, I just want to add, you know, we have done a lot of hand wringing in our office about how could we use our office space for housing? How could we bring people into our conference room, put up cots? It's not legal. They're not allowed to be habitated by humans. They don't have the right fire safety protocol. We'll be shut down by the fire chief in no time. So that's the reason, is that there's a very practical reason why, is the laws and the rules. The churches is another question. They usually don't have fire suppression in order to allow people to sleep or habitate in their large spaces.
Yeah.
So that's the reason that obvious isn't utilized. But I love the way you're thinking, and we've been down that road many times trying to figure it out ourselves.
Yeah. Gotcha.
And I think historically, yeah, sorry.
No, go ahead, Hadley. Go ahead.
I just historically, I believe that there were churches used back mm-hmm. in the day, certainly in some of these communities too. But again, it became an issue of restriction and insurance that made it impossible.
All right, Philip, you got the last word. We've got about 45 seconds.
Well, just very briefly, that's precisely why so many communities are looking to excess motel and hotel space in them to increase the amount of space, not only as permanent tenancies, but some of them are using those hotels and motels as overflow space. In the wake of the pandemic, those spaces are available at lesser prices than they once were. Mm-hmm. There are creative ways to get this done.
Right. Yes. Philip Mangano is president and CEO of the American Roundtable to Abolish Homelessness. Laura Russo is director of shelter services at St. Joseph's Shelter in Hyannis. Elisa Magnata, CEO of Housing Assistance Corporation. Hadley Luddy, CEO of the Homeless Prevention Council and state rep for the 4th Barnstable District. We'll have a link at our website to their organizations, capeandislands.org. Thank you all for being here, and thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.